Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jeff Shara, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Steel Wave, a novel of World War II, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have David Sedaris and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Just a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore, and thank you for silencing your cell phones. Widely known as the coin and precious metals dealer in Florida, in 1988, when his father, author of Killer Angels, died, Jeff sold his business and took over the management of Michael's estate. In 1996, his first novel, Gods and Generals, was published, the prequel to his father's great work. Quickly went to the New York Times bestseller list, and the rest is history. Tonight, Jeff will introduce his new book, The Steel Wave. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Jeff Shara.
Did you catch that? And the rest is history? This is lemonade, by the way. My doctor says good for the throat. And the reason I need it, this is my 24th stop on a 26-city tour. The sugar helps a lot, so I'm still perky. Thank you for coming. We always have great crowds at the Tattered Cover, and I appreciate you coming out. Can you hear me okay in the back? Is this no? I need to maybe point this up a little more. Is that better? Okay. I have to, talk to you about what I do. I mean, what I want to do is tell you about this book and then do a very, very, and I emphasize the word brief, reading, one page, and then hear from you. And I've always liked to get questions and whatever you want to talk about. I think I just got louder. Growing up in the house of a writer, and growing up in Michael Shara's house, and growing up in the house of a man who believed he was a failed writer, which surprises people. The Killer Angels won the Pulitzer Prize. Before I go any further, how many people here have not read The Killer Angels? It's okay. It's not required. It's not like, leave, get out. But what Michael Shara did in The Killer Angels is he changed the way Americans look at the Civil War. Because what he did is he put you on the battlefield with the real people, something that most historical fiction does not do. And he put you into the minds and the psyches of the famous people who made the history, people who changed that day, who changed the history of the Civil War, Robert E. Lee, James Longstreet, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. I mean, names that if you know anything about the Civil War, you know them, but you didn't know the story the way he told it. And that was unique. It had never been done before. And the book won a Pulitzer Prize. And at the end of my father's life, the book had done absolutely nothing in terms of reaching a general audience. Well, that changed a few years later. Hence, I'm here. But growing up in the house of a writer, I mean, I remember I'd sit in on his creative writing classes because he would have them in our living room at home. He would have the students come. And I remember the first thing he would tell his students is, first of all, I can't teach you creative writing. If you get an A in my class, it doesn't mean you're a writer. But secondly, what he would tell them, if you're going to do this at all, if you're going to bother to try to be a writer or to try to write something, at the very least, don't waste your time and everyone else's unless you plan to at least try to tell a good story. That's all what it boils down to. I mean, that sounds fairly simple, but, it's a mistake that Hollywood makes all the time. Hollywood thinks they can dazzle you with special effects, and that's all it takes to draw an audience. Well, maybe 13-year-olds, maybe sometimes. But in fact, the best Hollywood movies are the ones that tell a good story. That was the lesson. Of course, what I learned growing up as the kid, hearing the stories, my father would talk about what he was going to write about before he ever wrote it down. I understand that now. But what he was doing, I didn't know. He was sorting it out in his own brain before he ever put it on paper. I'm the kid at the dinner table. I'm the beneficiary of that. I mean, I'm hearing about Joshua Chamberlain at Little Round Top and, you know, hearing about Pickett's Charge and Armistead and Hancock and magnificent stories. And I was the Civil War kid. I mean, I had the little soldiers and made the mock battle scenes on the floor of my bedroom, you know, all that stuff. So, I mean, it was right down my alley. Well, when it came time to do this and to follow in enormous footsteps, you know, I knew the lessons that he had taught his creative writing students, and I knew why The Killer Angels worked and why it found the audience that it found 5 years after his death, when it became a number one bestseller on the strength of the film Gettysburg. When I began doing this, I knew that I had to keep that focus. And when I got back, you know, with the Civil War, I don't want to say it was easy, because it's never easy, but it was something I was comfortable with. But going back beyond that, I mean, it was time to do something besides the Civil War. And I had no clue, when I started looking at the American Revolution, is there a story there? I don't know. I know the cast of characters just like you do. I mean, I know George Washington and Ben Franklin and John Adams and, you know, yeah, all that stuff. But is there a story? And I went back and began to do the research, and boy, yeah, I found a story. I mean, at least it would certainly, sorry. People keep giving me things. It was a story that appealed to me enormously, but then I began to hear this thing from readers, this phrase, and I've heard it so much, and I love it. And the phrase is, I didn't know that. I mean, I told you the story of Benjamin Franklin, and yeah, you know Ben Franklin, and if you pay any attention to Hollywood in the last 10 years, what you know about Ben Franklin is he's a dirty old man. Well, he may be, but in fact, this is the man responsible for the French coming into the American Revolution on our side. And if he hadn't have done that, we would have lost. I mean, that's a story. John and Abigail Adams. George Washington, there's a reason why Washington's the father of his country. Yeah, it's a good story. Boy, was I happy with that. And I started hearing that thing from people. I didn't know that. It made it very easy when I decided to go, you know, to what to work on next, to do World War I. Because first of all, I didn't know a thing about World War I. I got excited about the idea of digging into it, seeing what I could find, because nobody knows much about World War I. We get most of our history from Hollywood. I can count on one hand the good World War I movies. You know, Lawrence of Arabia, Sergeant York, All Quiet on the Western Front, Paths of Glory, that's about it. I mean, there's a couple others. But I mean, we don't know about World War I. Blackjack Pershing, well, that's a name we kind of know, you know. The Red Baron. I think I said here, the last time I was here, a year and a half ago, I was appalled how many people thought the Red Baron was just a cartoon character. And I also found out in some parts of the country, it's a pizza joint. Red Baron Pizza. Well, you know, no, in fact, the man has a name, Manfred von Richthofen, a magnificent three-dimensional character. This is the man, the finest fighting ace of the First World War, shoots down 80 of his enemy. You know, nobody else can do that. I mean, a marvelous story, tragic story. He does not survive the war. I got in, and he's the German voice in that story, Into the Last Man, the name of the book. Well, when I began to, you know, I mean, the Lafayette Escadrille. I mean, again, getting more into the research. Most of you, maybe you've heard of the Lafayette Escadrille. You know, if you saw the movie Flyboys, came out a couple of years ago, you still don't know anything about the Lafayette Escadrille. They changed all the names. It's, yeah, Hollywood. Well, but you know, it's a bunch of young Americans who go to France in 1916 to fly for the French. It's illegal for them to do that. It's against the law. America's officially neutral. They do it anyway. And what they accomplish in the skies over France, it's a wonderful story. The Marines at Belleau Wood. You may have heard of, you know, Belleau Wood. How many Marines here? Marines? I like the shirt. Yeah. I made a deadly mistake. I asked an audience if there were any ex-Marines. I found out I was vigorously corrected that there are no such thing. But the Marines at Belleau Wood, what the Marines did at Belleau Wood, they saved Paris. The French know this. I mean, we kept the Germans out of Paris. Had the Germans gotten to Paris, the war would have ended. The French were done. And, you know, that's a story most people don't know. I was all over the country touring for that book, and C-SPAN taped me, and they, so here I'm, you know, talking now to everybody, and saying that the next thing I wanted to do was Korea, because the same thing. Most people, you don't know, unless you were there, you don't know what happened in Korea. What most Americans know about Korea? MASH. And actually, MASH is not about Korea at all, even though it's set there and says it's there. It's a Vietnam story. But in fact, most Americans have no idea what happened at the Chosin Reservoir and don't know the history of what the Marines did there, and one of the worst periods in our history in terms of what the Marines had to endure. They don't know the real story of Douglas MacArthur and what went on, and Matthew Ridgway, and I mean, you know, Chesty Puller. I mean, all these characters I could throw at you. I was excited about that. And I started getting a little feedback from my publisher, and I said, well, we'd kind of like you to be a little more chronological. Now, we're hearing from, you know, book buyers and people around the country that there are a lot of people out there who would like to hear your take on the Second World War. I didn't like that idea at all, because the first thing that stuck in my head, what can I tell you about the Second World War that you don't know? Hollywood alone. You know, hundreds and hundreds of films, documentary. Look at the History Channel. I mean, stuff on World War II all the time. And, you know, John Wayne, has given us more stories on World War II. What can I tell you you don't know? And I got into the research. First of all, I mapped it out with my editor, and we figured out that to do the whole war would take 7 books. And my publisher said, no, we're not doing 7 books on World War II. So I began, you know, mapping it out, looking at the timeline. We decided to do a trilogy in Europe. Now, as I began the research of this, what I found out is when America, United States, gets involved in the Second World War in Europe, we don't go to Europe at all. We go to North Africa. I mean, I've had a lot of people ask me, why was there even a war in North Africa? Who cares? Well, I'll tell you why. The British, they're in Egypt. What's in Egypt? The Suez Canal. Hitler wants the Suez Canal. He gets the Suez Canal. He changes shipping in that entire part of the world. What's east of Egypt? Oil. Hitler wants the oil. That's why there's a war. There's also a war in North Africa because Mussolini, you know, Hitler's pal, dictator of Italy, Mussolini wants to establish a brand new Roman Empire in North Africa. And Hitler's attitude about that is, yeah, right, whatever. You know, you can go have your Roman Empire. I want the Suez Canal, and I want the oil. Well, there is quite a campaign. It goes on for a couple of years, and there's this guy there, a name you may have heard, a guy named Rommel, Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox. Rommel, I was very nervous. I wanted a German voice in this story, but this is different than writing about the Red Baron. The Red Baron was not a Nazi. The Red Baron wasn't fighting for Hitler. And here I've got this character who's fighting, you know, has pledged a loyalty oath to Hitler. How do I do that? It's not about political correctness. It's about sensitivity. You know, how do I get into the head of this guy? How can I like this guy enough to get into his head? And then I began to learn about Rommel. And what I learned was, first of all, he's not a Nazi. Never joins a Nazi party. He's a legitimate German hero in the First World War. He wins the Blue Max, you know, Germany's highest honor. He's a legitimate German hero. He's a career officer, and he's not political at all. And then one marvelous thing happens. Rommel is defeated at the Battle of El Alamein by the British under Bernard Montgomery. And Rommel is retreating across Libya, and he's doing a masterful job of preserving his army, you know, living to fight another day. And Montgomery's too slow to keep up with him. And then Rommel gets an order from Berlin, from Hitler, that says, no, stop, turn around, for the honor of your army, die to the last man. And Rommel looks at this and tosses it on the ground and says, the man is insane. That's the third dimension of Rommel that I needed to get into his head. He gets it. Well, when the Americans get to North Africa, the whole idea is we're going to come in from the west, Algeria and Morocco, and, you know, Montgomery's over here in the east coming out of Egypt, and we're squeezing Rommel between us. And so the whole idea is, you know, we're going to put the pincher on him and get him, you know, defeat him altogether. Well, When the Americans go to North Africa, we go in with a lot of swagger. We've been told at training camps all over the country, all these new divisions being formed, that we are the finest equipped and the finest fighting soldiers in the world. Propaganda works both ways. The Germans are being bucket-fed propaganda. But in fact, we're getting it too. Giant posters in these training centers with cartoonish pictures of the Japanese as sort of these guys with Coke bottle thick glasses and buck teeth. And the word is, well, they're half blind, so they can't even shoot. You know, that's going to be easy. The Germans, Hitler is portrayed as this sort of one-dimensional cartoon, goose-stepping, cartoonish character. Charlie Chaplin as the great dictator. There is a Three Stooges episode. Mo is Hitler. That's what we're being fed. That's what these soldiers are being fed. So when we go to North Africa, we march in there with an awful lot of swagger that, you know, this is going to be a piece of cake. And then we meet this guy, Rommel, at a place called Kasserine Pass in Tunisia. Kasserine Pass is a catastrophe for the Americans. We are blown right off the battlefield. Now, Rommel is strutting a little bit with his victory, but he knows, as he's walking around the battlefield, he knows that, first of all, the Americans will learn from this. They'll be back. They'll get rid of the people who are not, that shouldn't be in command, and they'll come back. But then he's looking around the battlefield, and he's looking at vast numbers of brand spanking new tanks and trucks and artillery pieces and great big piles of food and supplies, all this equipment that the Americans have abandoned on the battlefield, and it's all the stuff that Rommel can't get from his own high command. And he looks at all this stuff, and he realizes when they do come back, we can't stand up to this. And it's only a matter of time. Well, Rommel makes himself such a pain in the neck to the German high command, they yank him out of North Africa. At first, they stick him in northern Italy with nothing to do. And then later, he is placed under the command. You call this sort of like sit down and shut up, you know. He's placed under the command of one of these grand old men of the German army, a guy named Gerd von Rundstedt. The guy's 68 years old. He's living in a chateau in Paris in all this opulence. And von Rundstedt's counting the days to his retirement. And all of a sudden, he's got Rommel under his command, who's this pain in the neck. And Rommel is put in the one place where absolutely nothing is happening, a backwater of the war, the coast of France. And so when we leave the Mediterranean and we begin to plan for this operation called Overlord, invasion of Normandy, people like Eisenhower and Bradley and Montgomery know that that guy who's going to be waiting for us over there on the other side, on the coast of France, is that same guy who kicked our butts at Kasserine. Well, that sort of adds a little, you know, a little drama to the story. Now, Eisenhower, I mentioned Eisenhower. First of all, when I started looking, the first book, which was The Rising Tide, North Africa and Sicily, I heard that same thing, people saying I didn't know that. That was so nice because that was really unexpected. Now, we're talking about D-Day. Publisher likes it when I do this. What can I tell you about D-Day that you don't know or that you might not have seen in the last 2 years? I mean, you forget The Longest Day, which came out, you know, a couple decades ago. Band of Brothers, Saving Private Ryan. I mean, we know the story of D-Day. Well, when I got into this, I realized, first of all, the paratroopers. What the paratroopers accomplished first in Sicily, the brand new 82nd Airborne, they dropped 3,400 guys inland at night into a place they've never seen, and instead of coming down in sort of a close knit where they can get something done, you know, keep the Germans back from the beaches so we can land our guys in Sicily, instead of coming down in a fairly tight area, the paratroopers are blown over 60 miles of Sicilian countryside. So instead of a guy finding 100 of his buddies in the dark, he might find one. And what they accomplish is a remarkable story. Well, the 82nd Airborne, you know, then they do a little thing, a little action in Italy, and they have every right to believe, well, you know, we've done our bit. Haven't done your bit yet. You got one more job to do. Actually, there's more than one. They're going in at Normandy. Only now, instead of 3,400 of them, there are 14,000. It's the 82nd Airborne and the new 101st Airborne going in together. And then there's the British Airborne. They don't even talk about them. They're on the other end of the invasion. I mean, they're going in as well. There's a whole lot of paratroopers going to be jumping out of those little C-47s in the middle of the night in an area that the Germans are basically waiting for them. That's a story. Well, it's a story I enjoyed. It's where one of my voices came from in this story. Sergeant Jesse Adams, this little fireplug, tough paratroop sergeant, magnificent character. And the adventures of Jesse Adams, if you want to call it that. The 82nd Airborne, here's another misconception. D-Day, June 6th. People assume, well, you know, the invasion, and that was pretty much it. D-Day, in fact, is the day, but the campaign lasts for almost 3 months. The 82nd Airborne is in continuous action for 33 consecutive days. They lose half their strength. And that's a story most people don't know. Now, Omar Bradley, Bernard Montgomery, I mean, all these characters, you talk about fun cast of characters. Winston Churchill, any British here tonight? Ha, good. I mean, Bernard Montgomery, with all due respects, is a jerk. And everybody who fights with him and commands him and serves under him knows he's a jerk. But what he is a hero. He defeated Rommel in North Africa, and the British are desperate for heroes. Winston Churchill knows we can't take much more of this. You know, the British lost an entire generation of young men in the First World War, and it's happening to them again. And, you know, Churchill knows, as he tells Eisenhower, you know, we need to do something quickly to turn this around. And the only hope for that are the Americans. Well, Eisenhower in command. I love Eisenhower. First of all, Eisenhower is sort of an interesting character because he is not a warrior. Eisenhower never in his entire career leads troops on a battlefield, ever. He is an administrator. And that doesn't sound very glamorous. I mean, he's not George Patton. George Patton, in the First World War, George Patton goes into battle riding on a tank, like it's a horse, you know, like yeehaw. I mean, that's Patton. That's not Eisenhower. But what Eisenhower accomplishes, he unites the American Army, Navy, Air Force, the British Army, Navy, Air Force into one force. These people hate each other. There's bickering and backstabbing and, you know, I outrank you and you can't tell me and egos, all this mess. And Eisenhower makes it work. And had he not made it work, we would have lost the war. And the statement I made when I was going around the country for the Rising Tide, and I'll make the statement again, and I baited audiences. I kept waiting for some historian to debate me on this, and it never happened. But the statement is, Dwight Eisenhower is the single individual responsible for the Allies winning the war in Europe. And I will debate that with anyone. And someone said to me, well, what about the Russians? Yeah, okay, right, yep, right, okay, good point. I'm talking about single individual. The Russians, Hitler makes some catastrophic mistakes. And then someone said to me this week, well, there you go. Somebody else is responsible for the Allied winning the war. Hitler. Yeah. I mean, Hitler, 2 million German soldiers die on the Russian front. Can you imagine if those 2 million German soldiers had been available in France? It would have been a whole different war. But again, I'll make the statement. Eisenhower is the single individual. Perhaps George Marshall could have done as good a job. We'll never know because he stayed in Washington. But Ike is a marvelous character, and what he has to put up with and the doubts and the anxiety is a story most people don't know. I have not mentioned in much extent George Patton, and this gets me to what I want to read to you, and very, very briefly. George Patton, first of all, I love George Patton. Most people's perceptions, perhaps yours, of George Patton is George C. Scott, you know, the movie. And the movie is not bad. The movie has some bad mistakes in it historically. First of all, it portrays Patton and Rommel fighting on the battlefield in North Africa. Patton and Rommel are never on the same battlefield together, ever. They never meet in combat. That's a nitpick. But in fact, I mean, so most people's perception is George C. Scott. But Patton, just to tell you a little bit about him, Patton, besides earning a reputation on the battlefield, Patton does something abominably stupid in Sicily that almost costs him his career. He likes to visit, and maybe you've heard of this, the Patton slapping incident. He likes to visit the field hospitals, you know, buck up the boys, go in and see the wounded guys, talk to them, you know, and he's got his silver helmet and his pistols, and the boys love it. You know, they just love it when General Patton, old blood and guts, comes in. And, you know, Patton goes into this one field hospital in Sicily, and he sees one kid sitting kind of curled up on the cot, and the kid's not wounded. And Patton's, you know, what the kid's suffering from is what we would call shell shock, you know, battle fatigue. And Patton blows up. And is furious at this kid. What are you doing in here? That's a bed we need for a wounded soldier, you know, not a coward. And Patton starts screaming at the kid, and the kid starts to cry, and Patton belts him. Pow. Knocks his helmet off the kid's head. The helmet rolls across the hospital. And then Patton pulls his pistol and points it at the kid's head, and he's screaming at the kid. The doctor in command at this hospital is outraged. He bypasses chain of command, writes a letter to Eisenhower, tells him exactly what Patton has done. We have the letter. Well, it almost cost Patton his career. Eisenhower realizes, you know, we need this guy on a battlefield. I don't need this kind of stupidity. And George Marshall goes to bat for him. They try to keep it quiet. It doesn't work. It blows up in the newspapers in this country. Congressmen are calling for Patton's head. Just by the skin of his teeth is Patton allowed to keep his career. Well, when he goes to England, you know, to beginning the planning for the invasion of Normandy, Patton, first of all, he wants to be the first guy out of the first landing craft. That's George Patton. You know, yeah, charge. No, he's not going to be on the in the invasion at all. Not going to be there at all. He's not real happy about that. He's given two jobs. His first job, he's going to command the new American Third Army. And the Third Army is being trained in England, and it actually does not come into existence until August of 1944, 2 months after the invasion. But the whole idea is if we can get our guys on shore on France and kind of push the Germans back a little bit and get our supply lines going and, you know, reinforce our people there where we feel like we're pretty comfortable on the French coast, then we send Patton in. He's like this, you know, the new fist. And Patton maybe can, you know, because everybody will be pretty worn out from the campaign, but Patton can bring this force in, punch a hole in the Germans. That's the whole idea. Well, Patton has to sort of sit on his butt for 2 months in France training this new Third Army. But then he's given a second job. He is placed, called Operation Fortitude. He is placed in command of the First Army Group. Well, that sounds impressive. There's a big headquarters, a bunch of staff, a lot of communications coming and going. The First Army Group, in fact, though, does not exist. They build wharves along the English countryside and build boats, fake boats, out of plywood. They have vast open fields where they pinch rows and rows and rows of white tents. There's nobody sleeping under them. They have other fields with their truck parks, rows and rows of trucks and vehicles of one kind or another made out of plywood. And they have fields of tanks made out of balloons. And at night, they take a real tank and they drive it around the field so that if some German observer comes over the next day, he sees tracks, you know, and thinks it's real. Patton walks out in the middle of one of these fields looking at these balloons. He feels like he's at a county fair. He thinks this is the dumbest idea he's ever heard. But the point is that we are going to leak on purpose to German intelligence that, in fact, George Patton is leading the invasion. And he's leading it with this First Army Group at Calais. Now, you don't need a map. Calais is on the French coast, the closest point to the English coast. It's the most logical place for the invasion to take place. It's a short hop across the English Channel. It's a port. It's crucially valuable. The Germans know this. Half of Rommel's army is sitting at Calais expecting the invasion. The Operation Fortitude, the deception, works because the Germans want to believe that this is what's going to happen. In fact, it works so well that 30 days after D-Day, when we've already sent hundreds of thousands of guys across the beaches at Normandy, half of Rommel's army is still sitting at Calais waiting for the real invasion. Yeah, Patton still thinks this is the stupidest idea he's ever heard. Patton, as I said, he's on a short leash. You know, George, shut up, Eisenhower's telling him. You know, we don't need you to do something stupid. Well, Patton, you know, he's trying his best. But he's invited to speak. There's a group of British women have organized this club for American soldiers, kind of like a thank you, a little hospitality. So any American troops stationed in this one area will, have a place to go and with coffee and donuts and all this kind of stuff. And Patton is invited to speak. He doesn't want to speak. He's been told not to, but he figures, I'll go unofficially. And, the Minister of Information in Britain wants him to go. Okay, fine. So he agrees to go. And this is what happens. This is April 25th, 1944, inside this new club. He forced himself to smile and stared out at the crowd, several dozen civilians, mostly women in bright dresses and hats. Many were smiling back at him, and he nodded, showed dutiful appreciation, tried to avoid the drone of the speaker, a woman he now knew as Mrs. Smith, the chairman of the committee that had organized the club. She turned toward him now. "Before we complete the program, I know we should be ever so grateful if the general flatters us with a few words. We are certainly aware that you are not here officially, sir, and of course your presence will not be disclosed. I assure you, no one will repeat anything you say. Would you please, sir, just a few friendly words?" Patton held the smile, the crowd applauding far louder now, his brain firing a tank gun into the woman's irritating smile. Now she was egging on the crowd, more generous compliments, his name called out. He stood, waved weakly to the noisy throng, moved toward the microphone. His gut was turning over, and he steadied himself on the podium thinking, short, keep it short, friendly, then get the hell out of here. "I am grateful for the efforts you ladies have put into creating a welcome club for our soldiers. Previous to today, my only experience in welcoming anyone has been to welcome Germans and Italians to the infernal regions. In this, I have been quite successful." There was a burst of applause, entirely expected, and he smiled, waved, waited for the noise to quiet. "I feel that such clubs as these are a real value because I believe with Mr. Bernard Shaw, I think it was he, that the British and Americans are two people separated by a common language. And since it is the evident destiny of the British and the Americans," he paused, an alarm in his head, "and of course the Russians, to rule the world, the better we know each other, the better the job we will do. A club like this is an ideal place for making such acquaintances and for promoting mutual understanding. Also, as soon as our soldiers meet and know the English ladies and write home and tell our women how truly lovely you are, the sooner the American ladies will get jealous and force this war to a quick termination, and I will get a chance to go and kill Japanese." And the next chapter begins from Eisenhower's point of view. Rule the world? He told them we're going to rule the world? Every newspaper in England prints that. And thank you for laughing, and there's a point to that. You have to have humor in a story like this. I could have read something very grim to you. I learned that in the World War I book. I mean, World War I's probably the most grim period in human history. And if I just give you nothing but grim, page after page, chapter after chapter, you get numb to it. It loses its all effectiveness. So you have to have the humor. Now, that being said, I mean, George Patton is wonderful as a source of humor. But that being said, Patton is neither a clown nor a buffoon. And he's not the Three Stooges. And he comes back in this story in a big way. And in the next story as well. The next story, the third of the trilogy, the Battle of the Bulge, the fall of Hitler. Talk about some drama. And I was speaking to a group in Norfolk, Virginia back in February. And I said to them, a story, it just occurred, you may notice, I don't have notes. I'm not reading to you prepared text. I just kind of wing it up here, and I might go all over the place, probably already have. But it suddenly occurred to me, speaking to this group, the scene I would like to write? What would it be like to be that first American GI, you know, the 20-year-old kid with the M1 in his hand, who walks up to the gates of a German concentration camp. I mean, we don't know what's going on in those camps. What would that be like? The next day, I get an email through my website from a woman who says, "That man was my husband. And he died in 1993. He was a member of the 42nd Infantry Division, the Rainbow Division." She says, "I have the divisional history. I have the journal he kept, and I have the photographs he took. Would you like to see them?" So, and her name is Norma Alley, and she will be mentioned prominently in the acknowledgments of the next book. So, yes, now I can write that chapter, and I can write it with some authority. This is the first time I've done a story where there are living veterans. And as much of an advantage as I thought that was going to be, someone cautioned me, be very careful of that old soldier who puts his arm around your shoulder and wants to tell you all his war stories. Because there's a very good chance that guy didn't do any of that stuff. Because the guys who did the stuff don't want to talk about it. I have an ex-father-in-law, is 87 years old, lives in Tallahassee, was with Patton in the 3rd Army, crossed the Rhine River. He was missing in action for 2 weeks. When he came home, he was the only member of his platoon to survive. When he came home, he brought a German officer's Luger. To this day, we don't know how he got it. He will not talk about it. And I don't think he just picked it up as a battlefield souvenir. That's the point. It's not up to me. I get a lot of emails from people. "Oh, you got to talk to my next door neighbor. He was at the Battle of the Bulge and he's sharp as a tack and you really need to talk to him." Uh-uh. It's not up to me, you know, to push somebody's buttons and try to get them open up. You know, to open up to a story they may have never have told their spouse, maybe never have told their kids. I make much better use out of the written, you know, the journals, the accounts of the people who were there, who wrote about it at the time. That's in some ways much more valuable to me. Not to say I haven't talked to veterans, I have. But interesting, so many of the veterans I've spoken to, you know what they want to tell me about? They want to tell me about that week they spent in Paris and the mademoiselle they met, you know, and all the wine. They found the cellar full of wine and Calvados and all that. That's the story they want to tell. And it's like, well, you know, I kind of want to hear, you know, when you were out, you know. No, they don't want to talk about that. I mean, that's... it's an interesting phenomenon and something I have enormous respect for. I do want to do a fourth book on the end of the war in the Pacific. The Marines really liked my book on the First World War. I got a lot of very nice letters from Marines when I started talking about, because one of the principal voices in that story is a 19-year-old Marine private. And when I started talking about Korea, the Marines were very encouraging. And then... now, lately, I'm getting letters from Marines saying things like, "Europe? What's this Europe stuff? We're not in Europe. You know, there's that other war going on, you know?" So, yeah, no, I get it. I really would like to do the end of the war, Okinawa, the bomb, you know, from the Japanese point of view, from the point of view of the soldiers who were on the transport ships waiting to invade mainland Japan when the bomb was dropped. I've talked to two of those. My publisher agreed that I could do a trilogy on the Second World War. What they didn't realize is that my idea of a trilogy is 4 books. And I have just enough clout to get away with that. After that, I mean, that story leads to Korea. I've been talking about going back to the Civil War. I hear from a lot of Civil War people like, "Hey, you forgot all about us." No, I mean, with the sesquicentennial coming up, it makes a lot of sense. Regardless, I want to wrap this up by saying, I know you've heard the number, and I'm not sure how accurate it is, but the number is that every day we lose 1,000 of these veterans, every day. And I take that very seriously, and I realize when I'm working on this story, you know, that with every one of those 1,000 veterans daily goes a story. And that's the inspiration for me. And so at the very least, what I'm trying to do is pay some tribute and honor those people, because you know what they did? They saved us. That's not exaggeration. It's not hyperbole. They saved the world. And they deserve to be remembered. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for David Sedaris and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 11th, 2008.